Hello and welcome to River Writers, a production of the Writers Guild of Astoria, a 501c3 nonprofit supporting writers and the literary arts in Astoria and the Lower Columbia region. I'm your host, Marianne Monson. Aired the second Monday of each month at 9 a.m., River Writers provides a chance to peek behind the curtain at the craft of writing. What motivates writers to do the work they do, and what have they learned through their creative process? I'm thrilled to have in the studio with me today, local Astoria poet, Jim Dott. Welcome, Jim.
Well, thank you, Marianne.
And
pleasure
I do,
to be here. Yes,
it's so great to have you in the studio. I know you're no stranger to this studio.
No, I've been doing stuff with KMUN since about 1984.
Yeah, so it's been a minute.
Yeah, quite a few.
So you're a regular on the Bedtime Stories show now?
Every other Wednesday, and did a few other shows over the years.
Yeah, and one that was about writers too, A Calendar of Writers, yeah?
Yes, that was back in the 2000s. I'm not sure how far back before that. Mm-hmm. But I did it with Barbara Hansel and then Karen Temple. We would pick a writer whose birthday it was and then do a short bio and selection of their work, about 5 to 8 minutes. And it was a weekly show.
Yeah.
And it aired mostly on Carol's show on Fridays.
Nice. That's great. Yeah, that was before my time, but I appreciate the effort. So basically you'd be like, it's Emily Dickinson's birthday. Let's talk about who she was.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fun. That's very cool. Well, welcome back to the studio on the other side of the mics. And you, I believe, were born in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon, but then you actually grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, my dad was a geologist, and for a couple of years they were looking for oil in Oregon, which they never found, but that's why I was born in Eugene.
Hmm.
And then he was in ROTC for a couple of years in Boston area where my sister was born, and then he went back to work for an oil company in Pasadena where my brother was born, and then quickly got a job at the University of Wisconsin.
Hmm.
And we lived there. Well, he lived there the rest of his life. My parents lived there. So.
Hmm.
And my other two siblings were born there. So.
Yeah. Okay. So you mostly grew up in the Midwest and then made your way here. How did you end up back in Oregon?
Well, I had spent quite a bit of time here. My dad was doing research on the southern Oregon coast around Brookings and Gold Beach, Pistol River area.
That's such a beautiful area.
Yeah. And so we would come out here many summers and spend time here. So I always had a warm place in my heart. And a friend of mine from university, and actually I knew him since junior high, was in the landscape architecture department at U of O. And I had just finished up working in New Mexico for the Forest Service, kind of footloose, and decided to try Eugene again. And I've been in Oregon ever since. So.
Gotcha. That's great. And your first career, or at least one of your careers, was as an elementary school teacher. Is that right?
Yes. I taught Napa area, then Clatskanie area, and overseas for a couple years in Malaysia.
Wow, that's an interesting place to go teach.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. Did you just sign up for one of the, like, teach abroad programs kind of thing?
Well, it was an international school, so
okay.
They have these fairs around the country for getting American teachers jobs. So you go to the fair and hope to get a job, and I did.
Yeah, that's fun. That must have been an adventure.
It was quite an adventure, yeah.
Was that when you were still single, or were you married?
No, I was toward the end of my career. So I was married, okay. And we had a daughter, so yeah.
And they went with you?
They went with us, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a really fun adventure. So, I mean, I'm curious. So you had this, where did writing start coming into your life?
Oh, since, probably elementary school, I used to write stories. And then my two youngest siblings, I would tell them stories at night, you know, make up a story and tell it to them, and then write some of them down. Like old Joe Silvertoe was some character. That's about all I remember from it. But and I told this story about the Phantom Canoe, which was on some property my grandparents had. It was just an old log floating around, but it turned out I scared my sister a lot. So
you told the story well enough.
I guess so. Yeah,
seemed
really
true.
Too true. So that, and then I started writing poetry, I think, in high school, yeah. Not very good stuff, but of course. And then, you know, I took a couple workshops at the University of Wisconsin and kept writing.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot because of, you know, jobs and so forth until I retired. And then I could really dedicate myself fully to writing.
Yeah. Yeah. That must have felt like a luxury after those years.
Yes. Yeah. It was always my avocation. So, but the time.
But it didn't necessarily pay the bills.
No, it didn't ever pay the bills. Yeah.
So do you feel like, did it intertwine with your teaching life at all? Like, did you bring a lot of poetry into your classroom?
Oh yeah, I did. I had lots of stories and more stories than poetry, but some, yeah, poetry for sure. And getting kids to write poetry.
Yeah.
Always did some of that. And then with bedtime stories, that would kind of segued from reading stories to kids at school and then doing it over the air. So, yeah.
Very cool. Have you ever written for kids?
Yeah, I've written a couple of kids' stories.
Okay. But what you've really written is poetry. So I believe you just recently came out with your third collection of poetry?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
It's called Touch Wood. And it's all poems on and about trees.
Can you tell us about the title, Touchwood?
It was originally going to be called Naming the Trees. There is a poem in there called Naming the Tree. But it just didn't seem to be, resonate enough. And then I was researching, the roots of tree, of the word tree. And, and it's all about truth and tree have the same root. And so, and then touch wood, it's making truth solidify in a way. And, it's good luck. It's, and even more than just good luck, but bringing good things into existence. So it seemed like a better title.
Yeah, it's really lovely. I was excited when I saw the title because I think I told you this, but a few years ago for one of my novel projects, I was in Wales doing some research and I had not heard the phrase touch wood before, but it's basically like the original phrase that we have now colloquially as knock on wood, like as as luck, right? So when we say knock on wood, the original phrase was
touch wood.
Touch wood. Yeah. Yeah. As a way to connect with the life force that is in trees and the tree of life and all of the long and great connection between humans and trees.
Yeah. Well, now that you mentioned that, I could read part of that poem that sort of talks about.
Yes, please. That'd be great.
So this is from Tree, Its Roots. Middle English tree, Old English trio, Proto-European, deru, firm, solid, steadfast. Also root of truth, trust, true. Touch wood, let truth solidify. Druids, dryads long since exiled from their groves, forests breathe but timbers felled. Not beings, but commodities, cloned, split green. I've dozed in your shade, taken in your outbreath, stolen your fruits, slit your bark to bleed you, snapped your limbs to feed my fire. I have lived inside your bones. If I could, I would learn your tongue's pheromones, pass leaf to leaf, scent root to root. Touch wood, trust, encircle us.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's amazing how easy it is to overlook the fact that trees make all of human life possible on a daily basis, right?
Really, yes.
Yeah, literally.
And even more so, you know, 100, 200 years ago, everything was made of, that we use practically was made of wood, so.
Yeah, for sure. But providing the very air we breathe.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
But congratulations on the poetry collection.
Thank you.
Would you like to read us another piece from it?
Yeah, I have, this one's called Red Alder, and Latin name is Ulnus rubra. After a gentle rain, the alder fell across the road. The neighbors with their chainsaws bucked up the trunk, cleared one lane. It grew on the uphill side, leaned into the gap above the roadway, not the largest along the stretch, not the smallest. It sparked no longer the glossy gray-green it was as a sapling, and the road was new. Muddy malachite or wetted serpentine, nicked by lenticels of the color it would become. A smooth ashen gray, daubed by white lichen, felted by yellow moss. Not a weed, but weed-like. A native pioneer prefers the riverbank, but being a prolific cedar, takes the open ground after a burn or blowdown, a flood, a slide, a clear cut, or a road. Grows fast with enough light and rain, yet we do not marvel at an alder's age or girth or height. For a time it gives its lead to wood and flat, creek, brook, and grove, as it prepares the way for its own demise, making shade enriching earth. Root nodules, home to bacteria that breathe nitrogen into soil, ensuring the success of sprouting cedar, spruce, and Douglas fir. Von Bongard in his St. Petersburg herbarium called it Ulnus rubra, from specimens collected in Sitka when Alaska was still on Russia's books. Nuttall called it Oregona, encountered as he birded and botanized through the Oregon country, 1834-35. Rubra grew in favor, color of winter twigs, dye from the inner bark, doubly red, alder roots back to aller, alor, to el, a reddish-brown hue as in elm and elk. The alder's white living wood, when cut, bleeds to rusty red. This one had its time, a middling human length. When winds tried to break it, it only bent. When rain and rain sought to drown it, its roots reached deep and drank. After the county road crew cleared away the rest of it, a sapling hemlock pinned beneath the alder's trunk sprang back, unbroken.
That's really lovely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There's a few names you mention in that particular piece.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell?
Oh, Von Bongard was a Russian botanist who, you know, people would send him collected pressed leaves and parts of trees, and then he would name, you know, figure out the name of it and key it out, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of early botanists got their names or put someone else's name on trees.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, you know, learning about the native names, but.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you said your father was a naturalist and a geologist?
He was a geologist, and my mother was a naturalist. After, you know, getting five kids started in their lives, she started volunteering at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum.
Uh-huh.
And then they would, so taking tour groups, school groups through, and that kind of developed into her getting a job with a nearby school district as a naturalist, and so she would tour the elementary schools and do different programs. They started a couple prairies.
Wow.
On the school ground, so.
So your parents, your whole family, basically, like, they really loved science and nature and the crossover between.
True.
Those, I can see that influences in your work quite a bit.
Definitely.
Yeah.
From an early age, we spent a lot of time, traveling throughout the West. Most summers we were not in Wisconsin; we were in Colorado, Montana, Oregon. So.
Yeah. For those of you who are just joining us, this is Marianne Monson for KMUN's River Writers, sponsored by the Writers Guild. This morning, I'm speaking with local poet Jim Dott. And I should mention that you use the name James Dott when you publish, right? So people who are looking for your book need to look at James Dott, which is not what I'm used to calling you. But So, Jim, why don't you talk a little bit about some of the poets who inspired you over the years?
Well, probably early on it was Gary Snyder and Wendell Berry. Mm-hmm. But then also Carolyn Frasche and Jean Valentine. I early on was fascinated by her work.
Yeah.
Which is very different. And I don't really write like her, but I think it influences my work some. And more recently, Loreen Niedecker, who was a Wisconsin poet. She was kind of a self-taught, and but she has really beautiful things that she lived most of her life in rural Wisconsin, and but very vivid descriptions of life, very condensed, very much like Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
She kind of is in that school of writing.
Mm. Yeah.
And I try to read really widely, so, I've read Ginsberg and plowed my way through most of Ezra Pound.
The classics, yeah. And have you had some writing mentors over the years?
Yeah. Let's see. Bob Pyle is certainly one, who's because he was instrumental in getting Touchwood published. He knew about the manuscript and the publisher, Watershed Press, asked him if he had a book ready, and they asked him if he knew of anybody else that had a book ready, and he said yes, and so they looked at mine and published it.
That's great. Yeah. That's wonderful. Writers helping each other.
And also Paul Nelson of Cascadia Poetry Lab up in Seattle area.
Yeah.
He's been really instrumental in kind of widening my reading and learning more about the modernist poets and, the Beat Generation, kind of digging deeper into that, of that. So that's been very helpful.
Yeah. That's really neat. One of the editors, David Bogue, from Turtle Island Quarterly, said about your book, James Dott's poems offer both visionary and humane insights. They draw us into a world where the natural world is matched with the inner landscape of self-awareness. His poems are filled with intelligent and artistic values. They will lead you into introspection.
Well.
Do you stand by that?
I hope so, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I aim for that, yes.
So how do you feel like your work has evolved over the three books? Well, can you remind us the name of all three of them again?
The first is A Glossary of Memory.
Uh-huh.
And so it's 26 poems, one for each letter in the alphabet. And it's sort of an imagined memoir of a woman whose father was one of the last sailing sea captains, so early 20th century.
Yeah.
And then it's her remembering her father and her mother who passed away at childbirth when she was born. So it's, you know, kind of a, it's all imagined in a way.
Yeah.
But, you know, it has some ties to my life, and I, you know, and this, my interest was in the sea and science and so forth. So, you know, I kind of delved into mythology about the sea and and the history of sailing and the end of the sailing era. So, and that was, those were much shorter poems than are in my more recent work. They're, you know, one or two pages at the most. So.
Yeah.
And the second one, Another Shore, it's kind of a similar, it's kind of a, you know, a novel and poetry. Both of those are novels and poetry in a way. Because it's a story of a young woman who comes over, presumably on the Mayflower. And, but instead of being abducted by Indians, which was always a fascinating, you know, story, that a lot of people would be abducted, whites would be abducted by Indians, or so they said, and that, but some would never come back, even if they could,
right?
Because they liked the life.
Yeah,
they were attracted to that. So that was my story. It was like an, not an abduction, but a voluntary leaving of her Protestant upbringing and going into the native lands. And
yeah,
so it's kind of her story told in little vignettes. Each poem's a little, moves the story along. But
yeah, well, your poems really exist at kind of the crossroads between the personal and imagination, right? So it's kind of a hybrid form.
Yeah,
you're kind of telling a story and also writing poetry.
Invoking a moment.
Yeah. It sounds like they often have a narrative thread, I guess, which is
different
than a lot
of poetry
collections.
Have been, you know, in loving narrative. Maybe I'm a lazy novelist.
You're telling the novel, but in poetry.
Yeah,
that's neat. So, I mean, it sounds like it's definitely evolved and changed. The first one came out in 2015, right? So that's 10 years.
10 years, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was the first, you know, I retired in 2013. So I got started on that pretty much after that.
That's when you really got serious. Okay, so take us into your writing process. What does that look like for you? Are you really regimented? And how do poems evolve for you?
I'm not super regimented, but I usually get a core of an idea. You know, I think A Glossary of Memory started with Oort, O-R-T is a little, it's a, from Dutch, but it means the little scrap left on your plate, scrap of food. I thought that was, well, that's an interesting word. Maybe I'll just write a bunch of poems about interesting words. And that really didn't seem to be that interesting. But then the story, and I started with that poem, and or just started writing it, and then thought about A and got into this character came, the sea captain appeared in that poem, and then from there, then his daughter appeared, and so the story evolved, and then it was research on, well, what kind of, you know, some letters are easy to come up with something, and
Q is a little bit trickier.
Quixotic, yeah.
Oh, that's a good one.
And Z.
Yeah, Z was harder.
Xenophilia. So that, you know, oh no, it was zero. That was, xenophilia is X.
X, yeah. I was thinking through that.
Zero was Z. Yeah, so some of them were easy to come up with, and some I just had to, you know, sit down with a dictionary or a book of nautical history and look for interesting words. And then, you know, the Kraken, that came in. That was before the Krakens were so popular.
Before they became popular,
Really popular anyway.
Kraken, not Krampus. They're both popular.
Yeah, no, they are. So that was that, you know. Once I got started, it's, you know, kind of compelling. You can't give up and just keep going and
yeah,
reaching, you know, just digesting all this information. And I do a lot of research.
You do?
For poetry, yeah, mm-hmm. when I write before. So I was reading lots about the history of sailing and, you know, where would people go? How would you get there? You know, different things like that. So
yeah.
to find pretty much nautical terms for each or something that could have been found along the, in the travels.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it all ends up coming.
You know, some of it came like geode. That's something I remember from childhood, you know, cracking open the,
yeah.
and finding all the crystal in there or mm-hmm. concretions and things like that. So,
mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, I can definitely see the presence of the natural world and everything you're talking about. Do you have maybe one more short piece from the new collection you'd like to wrap up with?
I could read actually one from a different collection.
Perfect.
This is another narrative, but it's sort of a, well, it's called Bar Joke. You'll get it. So, a crow, a jay, and an eagle fly into a bar. The crow orders a round, shots of wild turkey and draft beers. The eagle scans the bottles below the mirror behind the bar, says, "Make mine, old crow." The bartender remembers the crow, comes in often with an obnoxious flock of friends. She's never seen the other two. The jay and the crow knock back their shots, gobble like turkeys, and start in on their beers. The eagle leaves his shot on the bar, slowly sips his draft. The bartender senses there's going to be trouble. The vengeance smoldering in the eagle's eyes tells all. The daily flights through their gauntlet, raucous ridicule, murderous taunting, beaks dive bombed into his back. He's had enough. The wind has shifted so. Tonight, it will be one-on-one. The jay jabbers on, telling every lewd and specious joke he knows. The crow orders another beer, asks to see a menu. The bartender hesitates, unsure of avian dietary protocol, says, "Sorry, all we have left is the chicken." The crow, suddenly nervous, laughs, "That's okay, we hate chickens." "Actually," the eagle interrupts, "we love chicken for supper. But some other time, tonight." He downs his shot, wipes his beak with a wing, says, "We're going to eat crow."
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
It feels very Astoria too somehow.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Jim, do you want to let listeners know where they can find your work?
You can order online through the Watershed Press app. There's going to be a couple places you can get it. Winecraft has a couple copies, and hopefully some of our other bookstores will have them.
Our local soon. Bookstores. You have a website too, right?
Yes.
James.com. That's easy enough. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, listeners, on River Writers. And thanks again to my guest, local poet Jim Dott, for sitting down to chat about his work.
Thank you.
The Writers Guild of Astoria is a 501c3 nonprofit promoting the literary arts and serving writers in the Lower Columbia region. You can learn more and become a member by visiting thewritersguild.org. Until next time, keep the words flowing and your pencil sharp.